It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Following a short period this summer during which six homicides were allegedly committed by five recently paroled inmates, Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections John Wetzel ordered an internal review of parole policies. Wetzel has called the killings horrendous, but he added the investigation found no major systemic breakdowns. I spoke with Secretary Wetzel about his recommendations resulting from that internal review.
We average about 100 either murders or attempted murders a year. We are on that same pace, which, to just contextualize a little bit, ends up being about 0.25% of our entire caseload. We have 41,000 people under supervision. There was no consistent themes in these cases. There was no things you want to look for, obviously, is we've made a significant number of reforms over the 8 years I've been in office, starting under Governor Corbett, certainly continuing under Governor Wolf. And one of the things we were concerned about is, did these reforms contribute to these incidents? Did we see a major increase in crimes by individuals on parole? The answer to that is no. Actually, we've seen an overall reduction in the number of crimes by individuals on parole over the time of the reforms and post-reform. Did we see an increase in murders or attempted murders? And that answer was no also. And there was other questions that we looked at specifically. There was some talk about the parole board releasing more people, or releasing more people who committed violent crimes at their minimum. It's just the opposite. They're actually releasing less people who committed violent crimes at their minimum. And frankly, several of these cases were not individuals who were incarcerated on violent crimes. There was a DUI in one case and drug dealing in another case. So, no, we didn't see any trends. When you have five egregious murders in a two-week period, is it cause for concern and the need for review? Absolutely, and that's why we did it.
You did a review, but it was, I guess, an internal review. The Pennsylvania State Corrections Officers Association called for an independent review. Why not have the independent investigation?
Yeah, sure. I mean, we are completely open to an independent investigation. We'd be happy to provide all the data to whoever wants to do that. We've certainly had some legislators to do that. They should absolutely start with our review and see if there's any unanswered questions. Frankly, I don't think there is, but if folks want to do an independent review, we're wide open for that.
So after this review, you are proposing initiating some changes. What do you think are some of the key changes that would enhance safety?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them are around communication between different entities in the system. So in some of the cases, for instance, we had one case where there was a question whether it was a good decision to parole the individual. And in our review of that, we found that while the parole board asks for input from district attorneys and from the sentencing judges by statute, oftentimes they don't get that input. And even when they do, we aren't providing them with the type of information they should have to make an informed decision, like how was the individual's behavior when they were incarcerated? Were they participating in program? Did they complete programming? That was one real key area. In a lot of instances, there's decisions made by parole agents and police officers and assistant district attorneys on whether someone should be incarcerated while they're under investigation. And oftentimes there's legitimate reasons why we want to delay, like violating someone and bringing them back if they're under investigation. But that decision is often made at a level below the district attorney and certainly below leadership level at the Department of Corrections. So those are two of the major things that stuck out that we've certainly modified. We've also put modifications in to look specifically at individuals convicted of violent offenses and put an enhanced protocol in for them. So we start with a higher level of supervision, giving them the opportunity to work their way off it
you mentioned whether somebody should be incarcerated while investigation, while under investigation for another crime. One of the five who was arrested for the stabbing death of his sister and niece was under investigation for an earlier crime. So if a red flag went up, that parolee was being investigated for another crime, that could have prevented two deaths?
Potentially. You know, hindsight's 20/20. I will tell you that this happens a lot, that a lot of times there's a couple circumstances under which, and there's some actual case law that suggests that the investigation should be completed before we detain the individual. And in this case, given hindsight, it was the wrong call. And they were coordinating his arrest, the local law enforcement, as well as our parole folks. And I got to tell you, it's a good practice often if you're concerned about an individual potentially having a weapon and they have a scheduled appointment and the indications are that they're going to show up for their appointment, that's a safe way to detain somebody. In this case, there was charges pending. We were coordinating an arrest. And in the meantime, the individual killed somebody.
What measures can be taken to avert domestic violence committed by parolees?
Yeah, specifically around when a protection from abuse order is filed. And keep in mind that when it's initially filed, it's an allegation. And obviously, people maintain the presumption of innocence. But I think it's important that even when it's filed, if an individual is on parole, that we take proactive steps to make sure that we understand the holistic circumstances. And at the very least, we have the technology to put someone on GPS monitoring with geographic restrictions. In other words, we can restrict the area that they can travel in. And I think that kind of due diligence and being proactive makes a lot of sense until we get all the facts of the crime, until the courts make the decision whether to make the protection from abuse order permanent or not. So I think in that intervening period between the time a PFA is filed and the time the court rules on it, we need to take proactive steps. And that's what our new procedures will do.
Our guest on The Confluence is Pennsylvania Secretary of Corrections, John Wetzel. 2 years ago, your department closed SCI Pittsburgh. Now there are plans to shut down another prison, SCI Retreat in Luzerne County. Is that due to a drop in the number of prisoners overall, budget shortfalls? What are the reasons?
Both. Since we closed SCI Pittsburgh, our population's down over 3,000. We are well under our operational capacity, even in closing SCI Retreat, which we have proposed. And we're going through the legislative process right now that will include a public hearing in Luzerne County on October 17th, and then a final decision 90 days from when we answered. In spite of that, our plan was to not close the prison in this budget year, but with the budget agreement, we had a $140 million shortfall. And as a member of the executive branch and somebody who runs a big state operation, I only have the ability to spend money that's authorized. And given a $140 million shortfall, we had to take several steps. One of them is closing a prison. That gets us approximately a $20 million savings in this year and $40 to $50 million in the years moving forward. We've also closed a couple halfway houses. We've pulled inmates out of county jails that we were contracting for. We've reduced staff in our central office. So, yeah, we had to take these steps. While I think the timing, I would have preferred this be delayed a little bit. I think we can still safely close a prison and close that budget gap.
According to numbers from your department, state prisons for men are operating at nearly 96% capacity, I believe. Will this closing cause you to exceed capacity?
It will not. It will keep it under capacity. And frankly, I think that that we should not make decisions that put us over capacity. I mean, I will tell you that if you look back historically, the department has almost always operated over operational capacity. And one of the things that occurred certainly over the last 4 years, but really started under Governor Corbett, is we've significantly reduced our population. And more importantly, we've significantly reduced the percentage that we were over capacity to the point where we're under capacity. So we're able to close this and still maintain under our operational capacity, which is unique in the country.
You have indicated that there are 1,900 fewer inmates than a year ago. Why so?
A variety of reasons. One, you know, we passed the Justice Reinvestment Bill in 2012. That helped. Mandatory minimums were thrown out several years ago, especially mandatory minimums for drug offenses. That certainly helped. We've made significant improvements internally. The consolidation by Governor Wolf of parole and Department of Corrections has resulted in better outcomes for people on parole. We have a 14% reduction in new crimes by individuals on parole. We also have an unprecedented employment rate. 65% of people on parole are employed. And, you know, when people are productively occupied and employed, they're less likely to come back. So I think we've made some pretty significant improvements. I think that the fourth factor that's really led to this is that less people are being sentenced to state prison. Crime is down. And I think sometimes some of what gets missed in the narrative is, yes, our population is down from a high of 51,700 to now we're more than 5,000 inmates lower than that. But crime is lower than when we started this reform movement here in Pennsylvania. So I think things are, in spite of, you know, some challenges, and certainly don't want to minimize the fact that we have some parolees and some people on supervision who commit murders and attempted murders, and that's never acceptable. But when you look at it in the whole context, crime is down, population is down, spending on corrections is down, which allows us to spend more money in areas that will prevent future crime, like education. So I think in the whole, we've made significant progress with this system.
Final question, Mr. Secretary. Are you considering, do you think you'll have to consider closing additional prisons?
No, not at this point. I think that closing one prison, I think the key here is that we stay under operational capacity. Because while our population is down 5,000, that 5,000 inmate reduction reflects individuals who are the lower risk individuals. So while population is down, we've seen an increase in gang members. We've seen an increase in individuals trying to introduce drugs into our prison. So I think now more than ever, it's important to keep us below operational capacity so we can still operate prisons that are safe for staff and inmates and the public.
John Wetzel is Pennsylvania's Secretary of Corrections. Mr. Secretary, thanks so much.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence. Pittsburgh boasts a great mix of architectural styles that anyone can appreciate from the street, but have you ever wanted to take a look at some of these private buildings from the inside? If you think you're hearing fewer birds chirping in the mornings, you're not imagining it. Coming up, a conversation about how people living in bird migratory paths like Pittsburgh can help stop a nationwide decline in the bird population. And just ahead, a rare virus that can cause neurological problems in humans has been found in three Pennsylvania counties. Find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Pitch Perfect didn't exist back in 1988, and nobody had ever heard the name Andy Bernard, so it came as a bit of a shock when Bobby McFerrin's feel-good anthem Don't Worry, Be Happy climbed to the top of the charts. That positivity certainly resonated with listeners as the song became the first and only a cappella tune to hit number one on the Billboard Hot 100 on this day in 1988. Don't Worry, Be Happy took home the Grammy Awards for Song and Record of the Year in 1989 while rumors spread that McFerrin had committed suicide. He didn't, and in fact, he'll turn 70 next year. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, health officials reported the first human case of West Nile virus this year in a Philadelphia resident. Now another virus transmitted by mosquitoes, which can lead to serious neurological problems or death in humans, has been found in three Pennsylvania counties. Joining us now is WESA's health reporter, Sarah Bowden. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Kevin.
So what is this virus and what can you tell about where the cases were found?
Eastern equine encephalitis has been found in Erie, Carbon, and Monroe counties. Like you said, it is rare but very serious. Something like 30% of people who become sick from infection die. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it hasn't been found in humans yet in Pennsylvania. These
not
were in
this
animals.
Year. There was a case in a human last year, and that person lived. Mm-hmm. Yes, the cases have been found in two horses, a wild pheasant, and a wild turkey.
How concerned should we be about this virus? You said one person contracted it last year in Pennsylvania and survived, but it is. I mean, that's a pretty high fatality rate, actually, that you were citing.
Yeah. So it's actually been a pretty active year for Triple E, or EEE, as some people call it. So far, 8 people nationally have died, 3 in Massachusetts, 3 in Michigan, 1 in Connecticut, and 1 in Rhode Island. So people should, you know, wear DEET, get rid of standing water on your property. If you have to be out at dusk or dawn, make sure you're taking precautions, long sleeves, that kind of thing.
You mentioned Erie, Monroe, Carbon counties. What, if anything, is being done in those counties to stop the spread or stop more cases from developing?
So the county health department, and I believe it's Monroe County, is conducting a survey. And then if there is a risk, it will be spraying. And the DEP is doing the same in Erie and Carbon counties, Carbon County. And so what that means is they're going to survey to see if there's an adult population that of mosquitoes where EEE is circulating. And if that's the case, then they're going to spray to kill those adult mosquitoes to try and stop the cycle, where mosquitoes infect birds, and then uninfected mosquitoes will bite birds, and then it's kind of like this, you know, cycle of EEE.
Can humans be carriers of Triple E?
No.
So it's not contagious?
No, you can't catch EEE from a human or a horse, just mosquitoes.
Right. You mentioned other states, and they've had fatalities. Mm-hmm. Do officials know why the number of cases, at least in those states, are increasing?
You know, nobody knows why, but what we do know is that vector-borne illnesses are on the rise. You mentioned West Nile at the beginning of this, and there's a lot of scientists and medical professionals strongly believe that that is linked to climate change. The environment is becoming warmer, the environment is becoming wetter, and that's great environment for mosquitoes, which is great breeding ground for EEE. West Nile, then, you know, also Lyme disease, which you can get from ticks. So this is probably going to be, illnesses like this are going to be likely become more common in coming years.
So protect yourself against mosquitoes is the word.
Yes. Get your DEET out.
All right. Sarah Bowden is WESA's health reporter. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Have you ever wondered what the inside of the repurposed Kauffman building looks like? Or wanted to step into the lobby of the Union Trust building? Doors Open Pittsburgh allows you to do just that. The nonprofit organization takes you on self-guided and guided tours through theaters, speakeasies, and even a bank vault. It's an open house October 5th and 6th for some of the city's most historic buildings. Bonnie Baxter is the group's founder and executive director, and frequent Confluence guest and local historian Mark Hauser is leading one of those insider tours. Welcome both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Pittsburgh has a great mix of architectural styles that look amazing from the outside. Was it just natural curiosity that led to Doors Open Pittsburgh? Wonder what it looks like on the inside.
Yes, I think most Pittsburghers, and I think most people, the longer you live in a city or what you call your hometown, I think we all tend to sort of just take it for granted and walk past these buildings, drive past them, and we don't really insert ourselves or go inside to see what they are unless we're an invited guest or maybe we work there. So quite frankly, and this is a little embarrassing to admit, but I will, it wasn't until I lived outside of Pittsburgh that I realized how much I had neglected learning Pittsburgh. So I lived in Chicago for about 5 years. And while I was up there, I stumbled across an event called Open House Chicago and went to it. And it just blew me away, quite frankly. I was so surprised by what was inside those buildings, again, that I had started to walk past, train past, drive past. So I thought, you know, I think this will really, really work well in Pittsburgh because we do have a lot of diverse architecture and we just have a wonderful, rich history. And so that's, I kind of look at this event as an opportunity to tell about our past, present, and future through the eyes of these buildings.
And this is amazing both for natives.
Yes.
Myself, mm-hmm. or if you've just lived yep. here a year or less.
For sure. Oh, for sure. We do surveys, you know, after the event, and a lot of the common threads that run through those surveys are the responses are, I had no idea. I've lived here my entire life. I've never gone down that street. I've never walked into that building. So and that's really what the impetus of this event is. That's really what it's about, getting people into these spaces in a fun way.
Right. Mark, I know you have a fascination and appreciation for buildings in Pittsburgh. You have had access for previous reporting projects. Are you excited to share some of those glimpses that you've had?
Oh, absolutely, Kevin. You know, I do like to share the stories of Pittsburgh's history, Pittsburgh's buildings, the people that built them, you know, the millionaires behind them, and especially antique skyscrapers. So skyscrapers built in the first wave of skyscrapers, you know, that sometimes get overlooked because we have much taller skyscrapers now, but they have great histories behind them. And it also turns out that many of them have a great view from the roof.
And that's where you come in on your guided tours, right?
That's right. I'm very excited to be working with Bonnie this year and offering an insider tour where we're going to go to the rooftops or the top floors or as high up as we can get in four antique skyscrapers.
And they are these four?
Oh, yes. So we start out in the Art Deco masterpiece, the Coppers Building. Coppers has just redone the 29th floor balcony for its workers, and they've opened it to us. So we go there first. You get a nice view of the Gulf Building and the Strip District. Then we go to the Frick Building, which its top floor rooftop promenade, basically, is where the VIPs that used to come to Pittsburgh in 1910 would come to watch a parade or just to survey the scene. After that, we go to a building now known as Lawrence Hall at Point Park University. But when it was built, it was an athletic club. So in 1929, it was built by a bunch of gentlemen that wanted to have a bowling alley and a swimming pool and so forth. But unfortunately, the Depression ended its time as an athletic club. And then we wrap up with the Oliver Building. We go to the top floor lounge there and look out over the Allegheny River and all the surrounding Mellon Square and so forth.
Bonnie, why is it important to open up these typically sure. private spaces to the public?
I think it's important. I think it's a demarcation of where we're headed in the future, you know, as a city. Not only we're offering access to 55 buildings this year between downtown and Northside, and you'll see that there is a large collection of historic buildings, but there's also part of that list is newer buildings, newer spaces, adaptive reuse. So the diversity of the buildings that are being offered during the event, I think, again, reflect sort of the progression of Pittsburgh. And Mark, I know you could speak more to that more eloquently probably, but, you know, and there's also a touch of education. So in all the buildings, when people walk in, yeah, in most cases, they're going to be self-guided, but there's going to be either staff, building staff on hand, or doors open volunteer docents. So they're going to be on hand and be providing not just architectural, what I call dry facts about the building, but also anecdotal information about the building. And I don't know about you guys, but when I was in history back in high school, if I can remember back that far, what I really learned, what I remember was more the anecdotal side of history. So we really want to bring that forward because I think that's really what people latch on to.
Right. They add color, texture.
Oh, totally. Totally. And I one more thing I do want to point out is, again, when we get these feedback from these post-event surveys, so many people commented, well, the personal experiences that they've had in their lives in said building. So I think it's very safe to say that people do have like emotional connections with buildings. Maybe it's where they met their spouse. Maybe it's where they went downtown and went shopping, you know, met grandma for lunch. So there's definitely an emotional connection that people have to buildings. And Doors Open sort of allows for all that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, are there costs to take these insider peeks inside these buildings?
Yeah, the insider tours are separate from the general event, which are the 55 buildings that I just mentioned. The insider tours require a separate ticket, and there is a cost. There are a handful that are free, and then the cost will go up to $40, mm-hmm. and anywhere in between those, so $0 to $40. Mark, your tour?
A discounted $30.
Yes, how about
so
that?
So a bargain, especially given the amount of anecdotal stories yes. that I will be sharing with the participants. I think we've sold out for
yes.
our Saturday,
yep.
But the good news is we are going to add a 4 o'clock for both Saturday and Sunday.
Pawnee, how'd you get all these buildings, the owners, the operators, to agree to participate?
A lot of begging. No, I'll be honest with you. When I started working on this in 2015, I had reached out to the Pittsburgh History and Landmarks Foundation, and they were really, Louise Sturgis and her team were really helpful in giving me some introductions. Because again, I'm a Pittsburgher, but I had lived outside of Pittsburgh for 5 years, and you know how we are. We like to do business with other Pittsburghers. So because I'd been away, and I came from a completely different industry, I didn't know any of these people. So they were kind enough to give me some introductions, and I just kind of took it from there. And once I explained the concept and what Doors Open was all about, what its mission statement was, it was like a hands down, yeah, how can we get involved?
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking with and about Doors Open Pittsburgh. All right. What's the most eye-popping sight inside a building on this tour? Maybe the stained glass skylight atop the 11-story atrium of the Union Trust building? Something else? Bonnie?
Well, this is a personal pick, and I don't want to, you know, there are so many wonderful ones, but I remember the first time I stepped into the Kaufman's Grand Lobby, they have an entire video wall, and the contrast to the white marble and the wooden benches that are hand carved. That will never leave my memory.
All right, Mark.
Well, I know personally for the tour that I'm offering, the place that really, and this is open to anyone, by the way, so this isn't self-serving. You can go to this place yourself without joining my tour. But my favorite place is the top of the Oliver Building, because that's a building built by Daniel Burnham, he who built also the Flatiron Building in New York, which is more famous than the Oliver Building. But the Oliver Building is the tallest Burnham building in all of America. And from that top floor, not only can you enjoy a tipple from the lounge there, but you can look out the window and see this incredibly extravagant cornice, this really over-elaborate decoration on the rooftop of the building that is almost hard to spot from the sidewalk. But from up there on the 25th floor, it just is gorgeous.
All right. Any surprising, unexpected things that people will learn on these tours? Bonnie, what do you think?
I think, again, it'll give people an appreciation for the diverse architecture styles that we have here in Pittsburgh. I think it'll also give shed some light on our storied past, you know, from history. And again, the anecdotal is just, it's just overwhelming. Each of these buildings have a cool story. And what we also find, too, when people are coming through, they begin sharing their stories of the building. Mm-hmm. So
to both of you, is there a building that maybe from the outside might be a little underwhelming, but inside you get there and you say, wow?
I would say for me, one that's wow if you get to go inside is the Erot Building, which is fun from the outside, even better from the inside. Unfortunately, it's being turned into a hotel right now, so it isn't available this year for yep. Doors Open Pittsburgh, but we hope in the future years it will be. But just the marble, the brass, even the mail chutes are exciting to look at. Oh, that's a fun sentence, isn't it? The mail chutes are fun. But they are. They, you know, they have eagles on. This is when people really lavishly decorated every last bit of a lobby, because skyscrapers were a new invention, and they really wanted to show off.
Mm-hmm. And Bonnie, so maybe not an overly impressive outside, but the inside really grabs your attention.
Sure, and I'll actually, that's a perfect segue, Mark, to what you just said. The Erot Building is not open this year for Doors Open, but the Benedum Trees Building is, and it's the exact same thing, where actually right now it's covered in scaffolding, so by far it's not very attractive on the outside. And but when you go inside, again, the mail chutes, the brass, they've cleaned the marble, they've repainted, it's absolutely stunning. Mm-hmm. So total surprise.
And the rooftop of that one has been remodeled for guests, and it's pretty spectacular as well.
Mm-hmm. Bonnie, the rest of the year, Doors Open Pittsburgh, a one-woman operation. You have about 300 volunteers for the actual event.
Yep.
So what's it like to put on a huge event, dozens of organizations, locations, hundreds of volunteers, and then only you run the day-to-day throughout the rest of the year?
There are days where it is very overwhelming. I know that the first year I did this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is like, you know, people always complain about planning a family reunion. I'm like, you have no idea. This is, you know, 760 buildings, almost 300 volunteers. But I truly do love it. It's been a wonderful path for me. I've met some really wonderful people. And we're actually also expanding. We're now offering specialty tours throughout the year, right, which is sort of an extension of the insider tour model that happens during the Doors Open weekend.
All right. So, this is the fourth annual event.
It is.
And this is your first year being involved, Mark. So to each of you, where would you like to see this go in the future?
For me personally, I would like the annual event maybe to change it up a little bit next year and maybe do a different neighborhood. More to come on that. And I'm working right now on a calendar for adding more of those specialty tours. So the plan right now is to have 10 or a dozen of those specialty tours throughout the year. So that's my immediate goal.
That's terrific. I know, speaking personally, my only regret is that I'm going to be running around so much on Saturday and Sunday that I won't have a chance to see the rest of the buildings that are all included in this. And I know there are several that I would like to. So maybe I'll find some time in between tours to join them.
Bonnie Baxter is the founder and executive director of Doors Open Pittsburgh. Writer, historian Mark Hauser will be on hand for an exclusive insider tour. The full event is October 5th and 6th. Bonnie and Mark, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Have you noticed fewer birds visiting your backyard feeders? A landmark study published last week in the journal Science shows the number of birds in the United States and Canada has declined by 2.9 billion over the last 48 years. That's 29%. The American Bird Conservancy is one of seven co-authoring organizations. Jordan Rutter is with the Conservancy, and she joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Jordan, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how do you measure the bird population? We're talking billions of creatures over two very large countries.
Absolutely. So first off, I just want to offer that all of this and more can be found on the website for American Bird Conservancy, abcbirds.org, just in case people have questions. But the study was based mostly off of citizen science. So birders and other vetted volunteers actually contributed data. And that's important because there's no way that one individual or scientist could possibly cover those two countries. So it really speaks to the magnitude of both geographic scale and time scale that we were able to study this.
And you rely on people to do this. And I know here we have the annual Christmas bird count. Does that get included?
Absolutely. Yeah, the Christmas bird count was important data as well.
Of the birds lost, 90%, I believe, came from 12 bird families. Which birds are we talking about that have seen the sharpest declines?
So these birds are mostly ones that everyone either could recognize or name. They're backyard birds. So while grassland birds are ones that are, as a family, declining the fastest, birds that you see at feeders, like dark-eyed juncos and blue jays and common grackles, those are all birds that are declining right now.
What is the importance of that loss? What does it mean to us in our everyday lives?
Yeah, that's a great question. So birds are an indicator animal, right? So you can be anywhere in the world, any time of day, any day of year, and see a bird. So they're these really great, easy-to-study animals that really give you a health assessment of our planet. So the fact that birds are in decline right now really shows that our planet is hurting, and we need to do something about it.
So that is the why. Specifically, you say the planet is hurting. Are you talking climate change?
Yeah, so I am. And specifically, though, you know, there's so many impacts of climate change as well as habitat loss. So for birds, habitat loss means that they don't have safe places to live. And just like how people don't, they would suffer if they don't have a home or a safe place to live, birds are suffering too. And birds are also seeing so many other threats right now across the landscape, across these two countries as well as the Western Hemisphere. So there are things that people can do, things that people can actually take action and help make birds have essentially an easier life as well as migration journey throughout the year.
Jordan, is the decline a result of the climate change, or is it like an indicator what still might be coming? Could these declines actually get worse?
I think both, to be honest. I think, you know, we need to recognize what we are seeing as well as plan for the future and recognize what may come if we don't act now.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. We're talking about new research showing devastating loss to migratory bird populations across North America. Our guest is Jordan Rutter. She's with one of the co-authoring organizations. Jordan, Western Pennsylvania is in the path of many of those birds traveling north in the warmer months, south in the cooler ones. So how can places like Pittsburgh be able to discern these losses?
That's a really great question as well. And I think, you know, we all need to recognize, again, that we're talking about birds that you can just go out every day in your backyard or downtown Pittsburgh even. You don't need to go to a park and talk about some exotic species. We're talking about birds like red-winged blackbirds or Baltimore orioles. And so recognizing that we can do things today is really important.
Do things such as what? What can the ordinary person do to stop the decline, the loss of the number of birds?
So not all, but many, many solutions are known. And what's needed right now is action, right? We need to put those solutions into place. And these solutions are on an entirely financial spectrum. Everything from it takes no money, which means using your voice, speak up, tell your government officials to help protect bird with different legislation, or consider being a responsible pet owner and make sure that your pets don't impact birds negatively. And then you can take a more financial route and consider donating to organizations like the American Bird Conservancy, or consider buying products that are bird friendly, like coffee.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple minutes left. What do those protections look like in terms of, say, habitat protection?
So right now what we need, again, are safe places for birds throughout the Western Hemisphere. Migratory birds, they use the entire hemisphere in many cases for many species. And so we need to make sure that all of those pit stops essentially on their migration, right, just like this major road trip for people where we need gas stations and restaurants, birds need that too in their own way. And so we need to make sure that we're protecting land and prevent it from being disturbed or even developed. And so that can happen whether it's a conservation easement or actual legislation that is making sure that our parks stay pristine.
Mm-hmm. We have just about a minute left. The individual person, what can they do? For instance, I have several bird feeders in my backyard, and there are cats in the neighborhood that sit and wait. Any suggestions?
So one of the biggest things, again, is to use your voice, right? Help us create a positive domino effect. And so if you speak up, whether it's to your friends to help them learn about this issue or to government officials, it makes a difference. And if all of us come together, it really will have an impact. So one of the best things that you could do is help make sure that your community is aware that being a responsible pet owner really does make a difference.
One other thing that a person can do, I believe, we might have heard that sickening thud of birds colliding with our windows. What can we make our windows, which we love to look outside through, more safe for birds?
That's a great thing that everyone should take action on now. And other solutions can be found, again, on abcbirds.org. But just making sure that windows are visible to birds. And it doesn't mean that you have to reduce glass or that you have to cover them up. It's just about making a higher contrast, basically, for birds. They see differently than us. So they didn't grow up thinking about glass and learning how not to run into glass. It's not natural for them. So make sure that you either have different decals all over your window, or you can even get certain paint or window chalk, essentially, and put pretty designs. Again, it doesn't mean that you can't enjoy windows, you can't have windows. It's just about making sure birds can see them.
And we'll have a link to those suggestions on our website, wesa.fm. Jordan Rutter is with the American Bird Conservancy, one of seven co-authoring organizations behind a study just published in the journal Science. Jordan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, will the third time be the charm as the Port Authority of Allegheny County is reapplying for federal funds to build the bus rapid transit system? We'll have a conversation with CEO Catherine Kellerman. Plus, legislation would require adult changing tables in state-owned buildings, plus stadiums, arenas, and auditoriums. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.